May it please the court, Ms. Windsor. I had hoped to come in here today with some killer new case law that was going to settle this whole thing and all that good stuff, and that didn't happen, okay? In fact, it almost went the other way because on page 21 of appellant's brief, I cited Cosio v. State, and in December, less than a month ago, PDR was granted on that case. So technically, I probably should not. Technically, it's not citable law. Okay, this case, I'm sure you all have all read the briefs, but I would remind you that this case is particularly complicated because the alleged incidents supposedly began when the defendant was 15 or 16 years old and went on until he was 19 years old. Now, the court specifically pointed out to the jury several times during testimony, in the general instructions, and again in the court's charge, that they could not consider any evidence of anything that happened prior to the defendant's 17th birthday, because he was a juvenile back then. So it had to, if they were going to convict, it had to be on evidence of the of offenses after his 17th birthday. Okay. So all of the evidence has to be divided into two sections: what happened before his 17th birthday and what happened after his 17th birthday. Now, legal sufficiency, of course, is our most important issue to us because if you agree with us, that's an acquittal. So because it is so important, I would like to talk about it again, even though we talked about it in the brief, and comment on the state's response to our argument. If there's any case law that that addresses this particular fact situation, I couldn't find it. So this may be a matter of first impression. The appellant argues that the only testimony from any person that spoke to issue to conduct that happened after he was 17 years old was the complaining witness saying specifically, quote, you know, he contacted his penis to my vagina, he contacted his penis to my anus, he contacted his penis to my mouth, he contacted his mouth to my vagina, he touched my breasts, he touched my vagina. It tracked exactly the indictment. Okay? That is the only evidence of what happened after he was 17 years old. She does not describe a single incident that happened. And we would argue that, according to the U.S. Supreme Court, that testimony is not even enough to support a finding of probable cause, because in Illinois v. Gates and all of its progeny, as everybody knows, the Supreme Court said that although a search warrant affidavit may not be based solely on conclusory statements, there is nothing improper with using conclusory statements if they are supported by additional corroborating details. That's just to get to probable cause. That didn't begin to get to beyond a reasonable doubt.
So it's your position that the victim of an offense who describes, albeit without specifics, what happened to her is conclusory?
When it's just the statement right out of the indictment.
Okay. So if I were to say I went outside and he came up and knocked me on the head and stole my purse, that's conclusory and that's not enough to support a conviction.
You gave an You gave a situation. You said you were outside and he came up and he hit you and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You described an incident.
But he touched my vagina with his penis is not a description of an incident.
No, you're not in my opinion. It is simply tracking the indictment. So.
Ms. McBride?
Yes.
Do you contest that the testimony at trial court was that those descriptions that you just have told us about that were in the indictment and that was testified to by the blind witness, that she also testified that those acts happened two to three times a month after a fellow turned 17 years of age?
That's right.
So
but she does.
That testimony with the specifics that you identified, and testimony further that those things happen two to three times a month after 17. It's your position that that's a part of the record that isn't, but does not come with enough specificity to sustain the conviction?
I would say yes. There are absolutely no corroborating details of anything. Yes, I would say that is insufficient. Now, the state does not contest the fact that there were no corroborating details. The state says on page 13 of its brief, however, there was no testimony that distinguished between the multiple incidents. And on page 16, the state said, moreover, the jury did not hear details of the offenses such that they could distinguish between dates that the offenses occurred. So the state agrees with me that there were no corroborating details. On page 9 of the state's brief, they cite Villalon for the proposition that a child victim's description of what occurred need not be precise, and wide latitude is given to the testimony of a child victim in a sexual abuse case. Well, in Villalon, the child victim, the person who was testifying, was quite young, and the issue was euphemisms. She said, he put his PP in my PP. And the issue was whether that was specific enough to describe what happened. Okay, in our case, the witness was not a child. She was 19 years old when she testified. So Villalon should have absolutely no relevance to this case whatsoever. Further on page 9, the state says the jury also heard testimony. Oh, this is, they're citing the jury also heard testimony from two of KS's friends, her school counselor, the two Child Protective Services investigators, and a doctor from the care team. Well, the fact of the matter is those folks simply testified that Kristen told them something. They never testified as to what she told them. The only person that testified to anything that they were told was Dr. Kaufman. And again, she testified that she told me that he touched her vagina. She told me that he did this. No time frame, no nothing. We don't know whether these things happened before he was 17 or after he was 17. In Klein, then the court, state cites Klein because it says that the evidence that appellant touched the complainant's sexual organ with his fingers and with his tongues most nights or many times when the complainant's mother was at dance class on Monday nights is specific evidence of separate sexual assaults that occurred on at least four occasions in this 6 to 8 week period. Well, again, I don't think this case has anything to do with ours because in this case, the witness testified that this happened on Monday nights while mom was away at dance class, there were time frames given for when the dance classes were. And it was while the child lived in Carrollton, and this guy was sleeping in her bedroom, and he would come over and get in bed with her, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. There was a great deal of detail. In other words, she was describing specific events that occurred on Monday nights during the time her mom was away, was taking dance classes, and it included many corroborating details. So that is certainly distinguishable from our case. Obviously, there's no need to talk about factual sufficiency. That's gone. Okay, let's move on to unanimous verdicts. And I got to say, the state taught me some law here. I did not know that Mr. Sykes had no right to a unanimous jury verdict under federal law. So I argued it. We're going to skip that because apparently he doesn't have that right. With respect to the Texas requirements, appellant argued no, N-G-O, I guess that's how you pronounce it, and the state cited Dixon. Both of them are criminal court opinions, criminal court of appeals opinions. No came out in 2005. Dixon came out in 2006. No says that if the state proves multiple occurrences of the same offense, the jury must unanimously agree with which specific occurrence they are using to convict. They have to unanimously agree. If it happened on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, they have to unanimously agree that they're convicting for the offense that occurred on Monday, or they're all unanimously agreeing to the offense that occurred on Tuesday or on Wednesday.
Was there ever a request that the state elect?
No. However, no says you don't have to elect. No says that's absolutely unnecessary, that the court must give specific instructions that the jury has to be unanimous as to which specific instance it's convicting on.
That the, have you ever attained that? Under the law in the state of Texas, if there's not an election, how can you ever know that when there's the on or about and the guilty or not guilty?
Okay. That was what No said. The state relied on Dixon. Dixon said the exact opposite. Dixon said if she testified to a zillion different occurrences, we don't have to have a unanimity, okay? Now, as a concurring opinion to Dixon, Judge Cochran spoke to that exact issue, that the law says you're supposed to specify which exact crime you're talking about, which exact incident you're talking about, you're convicting on, whereas children, particularly young children, have no sense of time. They can't tell you what day something happened on. They just don't know. And so she was concurring with the Dixon holding that you don't need unanimity. And in that same concurrence, she pointed out these two dichotomies and asked the legislature to pass a law that would take care of that. And, of course, in 2007, they passed 2102, which is the continuing child abuse statute. That gets us around this problem with unanimity of jury verdicts. But what happens to the cases that happened before 2102? What happens when the complaining witness is 19 years old when she testifies? She's not a child that doesn't have any sense of time.
Just because she's 19 when she testifies, she wasn't 19 when it happened. You don't all of a sudden have this dawning realization that happened on my fourth birthday. Because I'm 19, I now remember that happened on my fourth birthday. Does it?
Well, no, but she was between 10 and 13 when it supposedly happened. And surely she could remember something that happened during the last 2 years to testify about, but she didn't.
Are there any other questions? Can you wrap it up, please? Your time's up.
Actually, I was just, I was going to tell you that I'm unable to reconcile the conflicts in No and Dixon, and so it gets dropped in your lap because you're the ones that get paid the big bucks to make that decision. So it's all yours.
Thank you. Deborah? Okay, Deborah, I've got some questions.
Oh, well, that's great. that makes it much easier.
All right. Y'all were never asked to elect, is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if you were never asked to elect, then what's your response to her argument of lack of specific event?
You know, and I don't know if this is a great legal argument. I mean, I think I've laid out as best as I can explain it in the brief, the legal arguments. You know, it sort of comes down to a practicalities in here, and that was one thing that I liked about Dixon. It's how could it not be unanimous? I can't understand what the jury would have been disagreeing about. You either believed this girl and you believed her testimony, or you didn't.
Is this really an issue of any attempt of a jeopardy question if there's a subsequent attempt to prosecute for anything that occurred during that?
I don't think there could be a subsequent prosecution because I think anything would be jeopardy barred because, you know, her testimony, it did at least cover the period of time from 10 to 13 when she says these, and she said it didn't happen after that. So all of that was there. We got one conviction. I don't know that you could break down and say exactly which date, but I would think they would all be jeopardy barred. I think this is it.
Isn't that the purpose, one of the purposes of election, to prevent subsequent prosecution for the same?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, and I think in this case, based on the record we've got, there's no danger of subsequent prosecution. I think anything would be jeopardy barred.
I have a couple of other questions. Her testimony was inconsistent. On the one hand, two or three times a month, and then one thing happened about five times, and another thing happened about five times. So I'm having trouble reconciling two or three times a month over a period of time from the time he was 15 till he was 19, and about five times. That's one of the problems I'm having. And how specific was she about what exactly happened after he turned 17? And my other question is, what is the evidence of intent to arouse and gratify when she testified concerning what happened after he turned 17 and pretty much just testified to the elements of the offense?
Okay, let me start with the last one. I think you have to read the record. I know counsel wants to divide this into evidence before and after 17. I don't think you can really do that. The jury had all the evidence to consider, and I think the first time this happened, he calls her and he's watching a porn movie,
right?
And these things begin.
So can't really prosecute him in grown-up court for things before he was 17, unless he was certified.
So. Correct, but I think his intent to arouse or gratify, that certainly could go to his later. I don't understand how you could not have intent to arouse or gratify when she's talking about the sexual acts that he performed on her, and she's talking about him ejaculating
on her. Touching the breast, or
The way she testified, the way I read her testimony is that basically, several times a month, he would come in and we would perform sex acts. Mm-hmm. And this was part of those sexual acts.
So you're saying then you look at his course of conduct, and starting when he was 15, any time he did these things, he did them with intent to arouse and gratify, because there is evidence that when it started out, that was the purpose, and it never changed. Or there's no evidence that it changed.
Right, and there's evidence that during these acts he ejaculated.
Okay.
So I think, I don't think it's any different than any other sort of case where you're looking to determine what somebody's intent is. You're always going to look at the acts that they perform. You're always going to look at the circumstances in which something happened. I mean, obviously, we're not going to have testimony here that where he's going to walk into the room and she's going to testify, he told her, I want to do this to satisfy my sexual desires. I mean, that's not how real life happens. But what we do know is that he came in, he performed sexual acts. I mean, there's just no other way to look at the things that he did were sexual acts. I don't see how you can not find that there's an intent to gratify, especially when you have testimony he ejaculates, and you have testimony that when this starts, it was watching a pornographic movie. So that's how I would answer that. It's really just like any other case. You're going to have to look at the whole circumstances, the relationship, what happened in the relationship, the specific acts he performed to determine his intent.
The detail is so lacking after the first three times, or what appear to be the first three times in her testimony. He was fondling with my vagina.
It is not the most graphic description that we've ever had, but what can you really, I think that's really just a matter for the jury as far as determining her credibility. I think if I were on the jury, I would want to judge somebody's credibility in part by those things. But I'm not sure really. She testified to the elements. Really, what more can she testify about? Everything else goes to credibility. I mean, how many ways
do you... And that's what I'm trying to figure out. What did she testify concerning the elements of arouse and gratify other than those three times?
Well, I think it's the circumstantial evidence, exactly, that we just talked about, that it's the pornographic movie, it's the acts themselves, it's the ejaculation.
Well, in most instances, and I haven't read the record, so I'm at a disadvantage here, but in most instances were the allegations of indecency with the child by touching her breast or touching her vagina the prelude to then sexual intercourse all in one episode? Because to me, that's one thing versus just come in, touch your breast, and leave. That might be another thing.
You know, it's not real clear. It's basically my stepbrother or brother, I don't remember the exact relationship, came in and we did all these sexual acts together, and he started doing this to me when I was this age, and it continued until I was 13. There's not a lot of detail here, but I submit there doesn't have to be. That really goes to her credibility. That's certainly something that the jury consider. I don't want to say it doesn't matter, because certainly it does matter, but it matters as far as does the jury believe her. The sufficiency looks at, is there evidence on these elements? And if there's evidence on the elements, then a rational trier of fact could find that.
Is there anything in the record to suggest she knew what a vagina was? Because he fondled me on the vagina. The vagina is an internal organ. You can't fondle somebody on their vagina.
Well, but she also testified that he ejaculated on her stomach.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know, that I substituted the word abdomen for that. I think most of the cases you look at, the vagina is the female sexual organ.
It's not. The external organs are the labia. And the vagina is
I don't remember because that was not an issue that was raised in the brief, so I'd have to go back and look at the testimony to see exactly what we covered on that. But
in count six, y'all pled touching, right?
Correct.
Touching the sexual organ, but you didn't allege with what?
Correct.
And you also alleged genital contact. So touching with the penis satisfies two different counts.
It could have, and basically my answer on this is that had there been an objection, maybe we would know more, but there was no double jeopardy complaint raised, and it's not clearly apparent on the record because there was testimony that he used his fingers to touch her. So, and the way it was argued to the jury, that was what the jury, you know, the arguments were to the jury. So I think that there is certainly evidence to support a separate count for that. And we don't really know. It's not apparent from the record what the jury did, so there's no double jeopardy violation. There's evidence to support the fingers touching. There's evidence to support genital contact. If there had been an objection, maybe it would be different. But on the record that we have, with no objection, it's not clearly apparent on the face of the record. I think that I've covered everything as best I can in the brief. I will be, if there are questions, I would be happy and do my best to answer them.
I'd just like to be careful that I saw the list of who testified and have not looked at the trial transcript. Paul Sykes did not testify, did he?
I do not believe that he did. It's like, I've had cases since then, but I don't remember him testifying. I don't think he did. I do remember the victim testified, her mother testified, a couple of her friends. Right. I don't remember. I think I would remember it. I don't remember his testimony. Thank you. State would pray the case be affirmed.
Maggie? Your Honor, you brought up a splendid point that I flat missed, and that is that there is no evidence after he was 17 of any intent. The only evidence was he touched my breast. Well, he could have done that while he was walking into the kitchen. There was no testimony that it was during some other sexual act so that you could infer the intent. Same thing with touching her genitals. If he put her on his lap, he might be touching her genitals, but there would have been no sexual context to it. So I would certainly ask the court to look at those two issues, which I flatly missed. But you've brought them up, and they're very, very important.
Right, if you missed them, aren't they waived?
No, if we talk about them in here, aren't they?
Well, you talked about them with Judge Stoppino.
The state was saying you could use the intent from the things before he was 17, but the judge specifically said you can't use any evidence of anything that happened before to make to convict. So they can't use his intent back then to convict on something after he was 17.
Is that what the judge said, or did the judge say you can't convict for anything he did prior to the time he was 17? Because if that's the case, there was no reason to let any of that in. It's a course of conduct.
Certainly. But since there was no evidence of intent after he was 17, if they use the intent before he was 17 to fulfill that element of the offense after he's 17, then they have used evidence from before to convict after.
Okay, but wasn't what the judge warning them against? offense with convicting him for any act he perpetrated before he was 17?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how he worded it. I think I've got it in my brief, but I don't have time to look for it right this second, and I'm sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Double jeopardy is a constitutional issue, so it can be raised any time. The state was just saying that we couldn't raise it because they didn't object to the wording of the charge. But I think that's – and, Your Honor, you did a dissenting opinion in one of the cases on this very point, and you –
A vote of dissent?
Yes. I can't remember the name of the case now. And you made this very argument on the double jeopardy issue that – if they don't say how he touched, then it could just as easily be touching with the penis or whatever. So I guess you're familiar with that issue.
I guess I better go see which case I dissented to.
I think, I'm pretty sure that's what it was. Thank you. Anybody got any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we appreciate your argument. It has been helpful, and the briefs were very helpful, too. So. We thank you. Your case is submitted, and you're excused to go about your business. And since our next docket isn't until 3 o'clock, we're going to recess.
All rise.